House number 13, 21334 CB, Greg Miller, LMFT, CABC, second, ICABC, LMFT.S, versus Emily Castle.
May it please the court. This case turns on whether or not a licensed marriage and family counselor is a healthcare provider under Chapter 74, as defined in 74.01-12A. Healthcare providers are those who render healthcare, mental, and/or physical care to individuals in the state of Texas. And the legislature has done a good job in establishing parity for mental health care in this state, and I hope that we'll continue that here today, and that mental health care providers should be entitled to the same protection as licensed professional counselors in Texas, as physical therapists in Texas.
Ms. Burgess, before I ask any further questions of this matter, is the time on the podium, Ms. Mills? I don't know whether she can see it from where she's sitting in.
Running right there. You can see it.
Yes.
I was concerned that it, I thought it was on the podium. I'm sorry. So the question becomes as to whether we're going to extend Chapter 74 into licensed marriage family therapy. Is that correct?
Yes.
So my understanding in reading both briefs is that there is no case at this point that expands Chapter 74 to marriage and family therapists.
The one case in Austin was Grace versus Calorito, and that was determined before the legislature amended the statute. So it's
what was the effect of the amended statute that we now incorporate?
It repealed the language that that made the list exclusive, meaning if you weren't on the list, you weren't a healthcare provider. Now the language is, it's more inclusive, and it actually requires the court to look at whether or not the cause of action requires a determination, most likely by an expert in this case, to establish a standard of care for healthcare and determine whether that standard has been breached. If an expert is required to do that for the provider, then it should be a healthcare liability claim. In order for it to be a healthcare liability claim, obviously it has to be asserted against a healthcare provider, which is the issue at issue here. So if an LMFT is a healthcare provider, as we assert they should be entitled to that protection, then therefore it becomes a healthcare liability claim because the expert is necessary to determine that standard of care. In this particular case, Ms. Castleman has established that Mr. Miller failed to properly diagnose and treat her PTSD. PTSD is certainly a diagnosis that requires analysis and assessment under the DSM-5, which Mr. Miller was qualified to do. However,
so is it your position that a family therapist is not necessarily always under the health care statute, but in this case it is because of the type of treatment?
I think as if they were treating a patient in a therapeutic relation, they would always be under this particular provision as a healthcare provider. I think there could be a circumstance, as some of the cases that opposing counsel has cited, where it might not be a healthcare liability claim because it relates to safety or something when she left the building or was driving to or from the therapeutic session, where it didn't involve the actual provision of healthcare.
What if it's just a therapist like a marriage counselor, and they're just, you know, trying to see if they're going to be able to save the marriage? Is that going to be considered also a healthcare liability?
I think the critical point is whether they're licensed in Texas. Licensed marriage and family therapists are licensed under the Texas Occupations Code, just like licensed professional counselors were, where three of our appellate courts have held them to be healthcare providers. So to say that a licensed professional counselor is a healthcare provider and a licensed marriage and family therapist is not, is akin to saying something like a medical doctor is a physician and a doctor of osteopathy is not. They just have different disciplines.
Different analysis as to whether someone is licensed and someone is not licensed. So then I would want to make, if you're just a therapy, but if you don't have a license, you are not a healthcare provider, but those who are licensed then are healthcare providers.
It would depend on interpretation of the statutory language because it requires that you either be licensed or certified by the state. So depending on the discipline, I think would be specific to the particular provider. In this case, Mr. Miller is licensed. It's established in the record that his license was active at the time and he qualifies as a licensed provider as a result of that licensure. So I do think that distinguishes him versus a life coach, perhaps, or someone without more specific training or examination by the state. And they're also, you know, they're subject to discipline by the state of Texas, and I think that also makes a significant difference. And it's public record as to whether they're licensed or not. So someone can look up and see whether the particular therapist they're going to see is licensed by the state and governed by those regulations in the Occupations Code.
So let's assume for your argument that, the provider does fall under the statute and the report was required. Your argument is that the trial court did not grant any extension. But in the record, the trial court is quoted as saying, so due to the COVID issue and due to the fact that the counselors are not listed, and because of the COVID issues raised by plaintiff, the court is going to deny the motion to dismiss. Can we not take from that that she did take into consideration the emergency act that had been issued by the Supreme Court and perhaps not coming out of granting more time, but taking into consideration denying the motion?
I think that she, based on the words in the record, she was considering that. However, there was no request for relief or an extension. And the legislature is very clear that if it has not been requested prior to the time, there are several avenues that Ms. Castleman's counsel could have taken in order to obtain such an extension. They could have filed a deficient report and sought an extension. They could have requested an extension from myself, and we could have entered into an agreed order. They could have requested an extension from the court. None of those options that were available to them, whether or not it was due to COVID considerations or not, were taken by Ms. Castleman. And so therefore, we would argue that while she took it into consideration the 36 hours before when the declaration was filed by this particular expert that COVID was at issue, this expert had been treating Ms. Castleman for over 7 or 8 months and had adequate opportunity before she, you know, within the 10 days of the deadline, contracted the virus. So we would argue that certainly there was adequate time, knowing based on their pleadings that this case was subject to Chapter 74, excuse me, that report could have been in some form or fashion provided to counsel appropriately and served within that deadline. So to fall on the emergency order of COVID-19 at the late stage, 36 hours prior to the oral hearing, while it may have been considered by the court, we would ask that it be disregarded as unfair and in actually in opposition to what the legislature has already decided. They have indicated on several occasions, 1 day late, 3 days late, failure to file is fatal in these cases. And so I think it would be unfair to Mr. Miller to include when a extension had not yet been before the court to consider that, you know, within 36 hours of the oral argument.
So are you saying that because it wasn't requested, I want to make sure I follow your train, if it wasn't requested prior to those 36 hours, it could not be considered?
Well, I just think that the consideration of the extension was not ever moved for in the pleadings. It was essentially saying that at this point, I learned that she had COVID and could not provide an adequate report. There was no motion for an extension of that deadline or ruling for an extension of that deadline by the court. She just commented in dicta that that was going to be the basis for her dismissal, and she also acknowledged that we had an opportunity to appeal it. So I think that was also part of the reasoning in her theory was that she wanted this court to make that decision in lieu of her grant dismissing the case. So therefore, Council also argues that there's a constitutional challenge to this particular dismissal because it would be fatal to Ms. Castleman's claim, and that this particular decision by the legislature is preventing a patient of a licensed marriage and family therapist from having their day in court. And certainly, like I've argued before, this court and many others, the Texas Supreme Court included, have held that this particular legislature has decided that if you don't timely file the expert report, the case shall be dismissed. It's mandatory and fees should be awarded. And so if this court refuses to or decides not to hold that Judge Connor has abused her discretion in this case, we think that the Texas Supreme Court would like to hear this particular case for licensed marriage and family therapists and to maintain the parity of mental health care providers in this state. And to finally get some guidance on the broadening of this particular statute and holding that healthcare providers should be protected. And so, if there aren't any further,
I think that this one is case law. Is there an opportunity to remand for a cure here?
In one particular case, if it's considered to be a novel hearing or a novel issue, in the first case for LPCs, the Norgard case, the court did remand it for an opportunity to file that report. And that, but in that particular case, I would argue that it was the case of first impression for therapists. I would say that we now have three cases with regard to therapists. Now, while they're under a different licensure, they are providing very similar services, and that is established precedent for you to be able to look at. And so I would argue that this isn't a case of first impression that would warrant remanding. We had plenty of authority that not only had the statute been revised to open it up to and expand to other licensed professionals, but also that we had three cases where licensed professional counselors had been held to be healthcare providers in this state. And so there,
would you agree it really is a case of first impression for this type of provider?
Yes, there is no other case for a licensed marriage and family therapist. I would just argue that the distinction is one without a difference.
Well, I was looking at the Texas Occupation Code, and they do list them differently. And even though they're similar, they are different. Do you not agree that they do have different authority and I guess place in the therapy world as to what they can and cannot do, and what can't do what the other one can do?
I think that there is probably more, if you're looking at a kind of a Venn diagram, there's more that intersects than doesn't. I think that they're both capable of evaluating and assessing behavioral, but they just come from it at from a different angle. One is based in marriage and family, and one is based more on a therapeutic cognitive behavioral type discipline that kind of generates from whichever program they enroll in. So I do think it's a different philosophy, but not necessarily that it wouldn't require an appropriate expert to establish a standard of care, because they are providing one-on-one treatment. Some can provide, for example, they will indicate that licensed marriage and family therapists may provide, you know, marital counseling and group counseling within a family system, but nothing precludes a licensed professional counselor from doing the exact same thing. So you could have, Ms. Castleman could have been seen by an LPC or an LMFT and gotten the same treatment from either one, just from a different discipline.
Okay.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
May it please the court. I hope it's okay that I took the stand. I just feel more comfortable up here because then my notes are right here. Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Hobbs. I'm here on behalf of Ms. Castleman. And as a point of personal privilege, I just want to say to the three of you, welcome to Austin, my hometown for 25 years. What an honor to have you here. And also, it is much bigger than yours.
Yeah, can't pass notes to the chief.
Well, and I also will say it's my first argument live since the pandemic. And so I'm a little bit just thrown off that we're together and you're seeing me in my, because it's been a hard 2 years, which we all know. Which actually leads me into my first point, and I'd like to flip the order on the discussion that we've been having here this afternoon, and to urge you that the clearest path for affirmance of this order is to conclude that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in extending the deadline for the expert report under the Texas Supreme Court's emergency COVID order. The order that's, I know we've read so many orders, it's actually the 40th emergency order that adopts the 38th and expands on it, including the deadline. And that order says, in all courts, a trial court may, in any case, extend, modify, or suspend any and all deadlines and procedures, whether prescribed by statute, rule, or order. There are some limitations. The first limitation is the first line, subject to constitutional limitations. In this case, we have no constitutional limitations. It's not been raised. I know of none. And then the second limitation, if there is one, is you can't go further than October 1st, 2021, which nothing in what the trial court did extended a deadline beyond that date in the 40th order. Well, I would say two things. First of all, there's nothing in the 40th order or in any way about this. This provision has been in previous orders, but there's nothing in the order that requires a motion or a written order from the trial court. And the reason why that's important is if you compare some of the prior orders, there was requirements for requests, and there was a standard. So just to give you an example, if you look at the 39th emergency order in paragraph 6, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but not the important language. It says, upon request and good cause shown, a trial court can allow remote participation in their trial courts. So that is clear in the 38th order that the Supreme Court knows how to say there must be a written request and there must be a written ruling from the trial court, or some standard on it. But that is not the case in the section 3 of the 40th order. There's not that requirement. It's a little bit of stretch of the record to say we did not request it. And I would like to address the arguments by appellants by putting yourself in my trial lawyer's shoes. He files a suit, and yes, he has been working with he has retained an expert witness in 2020. I think I'm getting my years right here. Fall of 2020. And they are working, the expert is working with Ms. Castleman and my trial lawyer to get this expert report on time. In the meantime, the defendant has filed a plea of the jurisdiction requesting an abatement because we have not presented our authorizations under Chapter 74 to authorize the release of medical records. So they file a plea to the abatement. And they take the position in the plea to the abatement that this case is abated until we comply with it. There's some dispute about when we complied and when exactly, but what there is no dispute is that then in February 16th, I believe, we did comply with that pre-suit notice. And after defendant confirmed receipt of that information, they followed up with us and said, we are taking the position this is abated until April 16th. So my trial lawyer, whether that's true or not, and in the trial court below, we briefed it or not, but my trial lawyer thinks this case is abated until April 16th and that abates his 120-day deadline. I believe, I am not arguing that on appeal. There is an Austin Court of Appeals case that says that's true, but it's still, in my trial lawyer's mind, he thinks it's abated. Right or wrong, He thinks it's abated. And so then he gets to May, and the 120-day deadline is coming up. He calls his expert witness, cannot get a hold of her, and does not get a hold of her before the deadline. It would be hard for him to have requested, and let me emphasize again, request is not required under, I think a judge could do this sua sponte.
You don't need a request, a mandatory request.
No, I do not. And I want that to be my first argument. But I also want you to put yourself in my trial lawyer's shoes to say, why wouldn't he have done it? Well, he can't get a hold of the expert. So he doesn't know for sure that it's COVID related. I mean, if you put yourself in May of 2021, chances are high. If you can't get a hold of somebody, maybe there's some medical reasons going on, and in this pandemic, it's probably COVID, but he couldn't swear to it.
Let me ask you this, and you probably need to educate me just a little bit on the requirement of the expert report, but at some point you get a 30-day extension. Is that only after it's found to be deficient? Or can you ask for that 30 days because you can't get the report within 120?
I will follow up with you, Justice. I think you can only do it if you need to cure. It's an extension to cure. I don't do med mal work.
You get the 30 day automatically.
Exactly. I think it's only if you file something. But I will. It's not on the record, but I can tell you my client didn't even have a draft of it. I mean, to file it, so we couldn't have just filed a deficient report.
So we're just looking at trying to get an extension.
That is all this case is about. This is the surest ground for y'all to write a super easy opinion that says it is within the trial court's discretion. Yes. But y'all have a lot.
So at this point, you're taking a position that this case does fall under Chapter 74.
We've always taken alternative positions in this case, even in our pleadings, and we certainly are allowed to do this.
So right now, your primary argument is it doesn't. But if it does,
then it's cured, and there is an expert report on file now. By July, there was one filed. It's filed. It has not been claimed yet, and I'm not saying they couldn't later, but it has not been claimed to be inadequate yet. So it did get filed before the judge ruled on this case. But going to what I'm going to call the merits, it's really not merits, it's a procedural issue too, but going to the primary issue that the appellants has raised are MFT's providers. And I would like to address this in three ways. One, I would like to talk about the Austin Court of Appeals case, because this is a transfer case, and I want to talk about especially Friday's opinion on transferring cases. I want to point out that there is no evidence for everything that has been argued today is not in the record about the difference between MFTs and professional counselors. And then I would like to talk about why MFTs are different from professional counselors. So I have three points to make. And the first one is the Austin Court of Appeals case in Grace, which is cited in the briefing, says in no uncertain terms, MFTs, and I'm sorry, I'm going to call them MFTs. I think y'all will appreciate that because I think you're struggling with what to call them too. Licensed MFTs are not healthcare providers. That is the Court of Appeals case. It has not been overturned. It is the only case in Texas that has addressed MFTs in the context of Chapter 74, and it says they are not. And so last Friday's decision by the Texas Supreme Court in Mitschke, the court had a really interesting opinion that we will all be looking at, especially I'm sure y'all who get a lot of transfer court cases, that emphasized under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 41.3, it is your obligation to decide this case in accordance with how the Austin court would decide the case. And the court talks a lot about stare decisis and when you might be able to overrule an Austin court and when you wouldn't. And as I read the opinion, it strikes me that absent the Texas Supreme Court overruling the Grace decision, you should decide it. I will concede that there is discussion in Mitschke about the legislature can also override it. But I will argue today that the legislature has not overridden Grace. All the legislature did was say, oh, if you're looking at this as an exclusionary, like this is an exclusive list, let's assure you that it's not. It's inclusive. So this is not the case where to this list of providers, they provided MFTs or even added any other provider that might relate to mental health. It's still the same providers. I'm going to challenge the three cases where they say professional counselors are LPs or are providers, or at least challenge that an MFT is the same as a licensed professional. If you'll, but two things. One, it was Mr. Miller's burden to present evidence about what the difference is between he has to prove he is a provider and he provides health care to his clients, and that in this context, he was providing healthcare to his client. And so we can discuss all day what I think the difference is between marriage counseling and professional counseling, but it's not on the record. And that was their obligation to do it. And so that's sort of my first procedural point.
Can we not look at the
That is a good question, and that is my second point. If you look at the Fort Worth case that decided that professional counselors are healthcare providers, and you look at their reasoning is twofold, if I may. One, Chapter 74 defines healthcare as including treatment of patients, and they focus on this word treatment. And then they went to the occupations code to decide, do professional counselors provide treatment? Well, if you look at 503.003, it says in four different places that professional counselors treat disorders. They establish treatment goals and objectives. They plan, implement, and evaluate treatment plans. So you see the word treatment throughout the occupations code as it relates to professional counseling. But if you go to the marriage and family therapy definition under 502 of the occupations code, nowhere in there do they talk about treatment. That word is non-existent when it comes to an MFT. And so even if you felt that given the chance, the third court would overrule Grace or distinguish Grace in some material way based on the change in the in Chapter 74, I would urge you that the very basis for holding that a professional counselor is a provider is undercut by the occupations code itself. And then, finally, I would like to discuss the last question about remanding in the interest of justice. This is actually not just a novel issue that you will be the first Texas court, if you hold that an MFT is a healthcare provider, you will be the first Texas court to hold as such. You will be overruling, well, you will at least be distinguishing a binding precedent from the transferor court. And the trial judge is looking, if you put yourself now in the shoes of the trial judge was looking at this saying, clear case law from my district, MFTs, they are not providers. I can either extend under COVID or I can say I'm following the Austin court, that's who I'm bound by. And so if there is ever a time for a remand in the interest of justice, which you as a court have broad discretion to remand in the interest of justice, we would definitely urge you to do so in this case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Given this case law that the trial judge had before her and the decision discretion for the trial judge.
Well, Your Honor, of course we would say, yes, it is. only because the legislature has spoken, and they have said it's an inclusive list now. Providers are no longer excluded when they're licensed and they're providing health care. And the fact that a standard of care must be established by a healthcare provider, and in fact, that's what plaintiff's pleadings indicate. You know, this is a Chapter 74 case. She breached, or my client breached the standard of care. And in the Occupations Code, while I understand the word treatment is not used, it does indicate evaluation, diagnostic assessment, and remediation of mental, cognitive, affective, behavioral, or relational dysfunction, disease, or disorder in the context of marriage or family systems, and includes the use of the DSM. So I would say that certainly these marriage and family therapists are providing treatment to individuals that seek counseling and therapy from them. For them to even review, you know, a psychiatrist uses the DSM, a psychologist uses the DSM, a licensed professional counselor uses the DSM, you know. And so all of those individuals, according to our current case law and statute, would be healthcare providers. The Occupation Code provides the same standards for LMFTs. And so we'd ask you to hold that they too are healthcare providers under this statute, and that that's what the legislature, obviously they can have an opportunity to do that and change that list again. However,
you know, my problem with the legislature is they didn't add to the list, they just told us it's not exhausted, and Grace still stands that, you know, LMPPs are not, and there's been nothing to change that. And so I go back to the word treatment, is what does when we're looking at all these circumstances and everything that has now come under Chapter 74, is what she is receiving, or whenever it is receiving treatment as the statute sets forth.
Well, she certainly thought she was, according to her pleadings. She saw him for almost in excess of about 9 months, and so she saw him on a weekly basis for treatment for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and complex post-traumatic stress disorder. She's essentially saying my client isn't qualified to treat her for that, but was qualified in her mind at the outset to treat her for substance abuse and PTSD. So her own pleadings negate the idea that she wasn't seeking treatment. And her own pleadings indicate that he fell below the standard of care in treating her for these particular diagnostics that are found in the DSM that could have been treated by a psychiatrist, a psychologist, an LPC. And again, I would take you back to Norgaard. Grace stood for the proposition that no therapist, you know, would qualify under the statute at that time. And all they did was look at the list. No therapist was on the list. It was dentists, podiatrists, physicians, chiropractors, those types of, and healthcare institutions, I believe. That's who was on the list. Anyone else was out. So it was easy for Grace to be decided in this court, in the Third Court of Appeals, to say, no, I'm sorry, you're not a healthcare provider, no reports required. That was in 1999. It's 2022. I think LMFTs are healthcare providers under the current legislature and the current jurisprudence in this court.
But under the statute that applies to us as a transfer for a court, we are bound to follow that precedent, as Justice Ginsburg has just pointed out, and so we would have to somehow distinguish it, and you're saying the basis for distinguishing is the fact that the statute now
has been expanded.
It has been expanded and it would be treated differently by this court.
Yes. And I think that the remaining cases that have interpreted, they say don't look specifically at, you know, that list and that definition. Look to see whether or not there is a standard of care required that necessitates an expert report. And that the Supreme Court has upheld, this court has upheld, that is the actual standard, not exactly what's in the pleading, but whether or not the trial court, and in order to establish the standard of care, you're going to need an expert. That's the threshold requirement. So in parsing it down to lists, inclusive, exclusive, that the Texas Supreme Court is actually asking you to look at whether or not the standard is, do I need an expert? Is there a standard of care that has to be established by that expert? And if that's the case, it falls under Chapter 74.
And do we have, last but not least, address the argument that it didn't need to be a written request in order to extend it under the court? Emergency order is
Well, actually, I think that this case didn't really, I mean, I would have to argue that everything, you know, COVID-related, we were all operating under a kind of emergency circumstances at all times. However, when you look at the facts of this particular case, and some of the case law even that was cited by Appley in this particular matter, those cases indicated the Kim case, there was a request for an extension. It was curing a deficient report. This person had been retained 7 months before, you know, and so for in the 2 weeks before he couldn't reach the expert, again, no action was taken to seek any relief, either under the COVID emergency order or under the current rules. They could have sought an extension of time from the court for leave to extend that deadline.
Yeah, but I think we had the discussion earlier with Justice Anina. You couldn't ask for an extension of time unless she secured the report.
No.
The only way to get an extension of time is if you had agreed to it.
Or from leave of court, and they could have at that time used the COVID emergency order when he couldn't reach her. You know, but none of that was done in this case within the 2 weeks prior. They could have sought leave of court under any circumstances to extend it, with or without my consent. My consent would be the quickest and easiest way, but certainly they could have asked for leave of court saying, I'm not able to reach my expert.
But there's nothing to indicate, I guess my whole thing is, yeah, there could have been a lot of things that were done 2 weeks before, a week before. I guess my question is, what leads someone to come in on the day that the deadline say, and due to COVID today, I need an extension? That's my question to you. What does it bar any person to walk in any day and say, I need an extension today because of COVID?
Well, I think the order is specific to say that there would have been, there's harm or risk to parties, witnesses, the court, things of that nature. It does include that language of that type. We don't have that situation here. We just have, I can't reach my expert. That's not, you know, the concerns that COVID brings. We don't want someone coming to testify that may have been exposed or have symptoms of COVID. This is, I just can't reach my expert that I retained 9 months ago.
Was that at the hearing for the motion to dismiss when you were first brought up, or was first brought up that they wanted an extension?
Yes, within 36 hours of that hearing, yes.
And was this for the extension, the COVID extension?
Yes, well, they filed a declaration from the expert explaining that she had had COVID during that time period.
That was 36 hours before the hearing.
Yes.
And how much time had passed from the 120-day deadline?
90.
How many?
90 days.
The hearing was when? Do you recall?
Yes, the hearing was on...
September 1st, 2021.
September what?
1st, 2021.
The report was filed July 27th, 21, is that correct? Just didn't have the
yes.
And no time between July and 36 hours before September 4th, were you made aware of any COVID matters?
No.
All right, we'll verify that. Okay.
Thank you very much.